You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
And for the next two pieces of today's show, just giving a bit of a trigger warning as we're talking about sexual violence and assault. And so if anyone would like to talk to someone, Safe to Talk is at 0800 044 334. I'll repeat that number at the end of the two pieces. Onto the first piece, I talked to University of Canterbury Law Professor Elizabeth McDonald on her research into rape myths. And according to her research, despite more than 40 years of law reform aimed at improving the experience of giving evidence for adult rape complainants, the Ministry of Justice research in 2018 reconfirmed the process remains distressing and re-traumatising. Elizabeth has written a book that compiles all of the research with some other researchers. And so I begin by asking Elizabeth to give me some background onto her research.
So the purpose of the research was to try and find out more reasons why, or trying to find the reasons why the adult complainants in particular in rape cases are still reporting significant amounts of re-traumatisation despite more than 30 years of law reform, some of which was particularly targeted at reducing the harm visited by the criminal justice system, in particular giving evidence. So that was the beginning point, and we were able to access 30 adult rape cases where the issue at trial is consent, because my previous work had indicated that those were the kind of cases where complainants had the hardest time, because it allows, you know, lots of inferences around their behaviour, around previous sexual experience and the like. Now, while we were in the process of that research, the Sexual Violence Court pilot, which has been running and is still running happily in Auckland and Whangarei, began, and I was able to get some further funding from the New Zealand Law Foundation to do a comparative piece of work. So another 10 cases of similar kinds of fact scenarios, so adult acquaintance rape cases where the issue at trial was consent, that have been heard in the pilot courts. So got a possibility of talking about what's happening out there generally, but also what's happening in the pilot, what the differences are, and what remains to be done. So that's kind of the background. So we found out probably quite a lot more than I was expecting to find out, remembering the target was really about what I've called reform-resistant cross-examination. Mm. And I guess, you know, coming from a really good piece of reform, which was closing the court to the public while complainants give evidence, has also meant that it's closed from public access and critique. So what we were able to do was to get the audio recordings of complainants with obviously the consent of the judiciary in order to determine at which points in the questioning process, and not just in the cross-examination but also in examination in chief, were complainants obviously distressed or were finding it very difficult to answer questions and participate in the process, either because they asked for breaks or there were big pauses, or there was obvious sounds of distress. And we also looked at, well, how are the actual rules of evidence and procedure working in these cases? Are they working as they were intended? So one of my areas of research is the admissibility of sexual history evidence. So I looked particularly closely at those decisions, which we normally only have access through because of the appeal process, so in the appellate jurisdiction, which is publicly available, but not at court of first instance primarily. So very interesting findings in that area as well. We also accessed the closing argument. So what is the jury told by the Crown and the Defence Counsel, and how does the judge then direct them on the law? And also, does the judge respond to rape mythology that might be being reinforced either during the questioning or in closing arguments? So that was kind of the package of material that we have.
What did you find that did increase the distress and the trauma of complainants?
Okay, so probably unsurprisingly, when there was reliance on rape mythology. So when complainants were asked, well, why didn't you resist? Why didn't you leave? Why didn't you scream? Why did you not block them on Facebook the next day? Why did you continue to have interaction with them? So all the kind of things that we know that not all complainants do. Like, that's this idea of the real rape schema, that, you know, rape looks like, you know, someone you don't know, that you would kick and scream and call out and resist and go to the police immediately. We know that not all victim survivors do that. Not all complainants do that. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they were not raped. So the kinds of things where complainants have struggled is the reinforcement and the constant kind of asking again and again those kinds of questions. But also, and this was a little bit of a surprise to me, when I suppose it shouldn't have been, but when they are asked to recall quite peripheral and minute details of the surrounding events leading up to the alleged rape. So things that you would not normally every day be able to remember, you know, was where was the suitcase, was the door open or shut, you know, how long between this event and that event. Most of which, and these are the points at which complainants got distressed, where they really couldn't remember and meaning was made of that failure to remember, when they were matters really of no import to the actual event that were significant for the trial.
And so are these rape myths being perpetuated by those who are doing the questioning or by the judicial process? What a dumb question. Why does rape myth exist? But I guess what I'm wondering is why does this exist in our judicial process, which I may be naive of me, but I would have hoped, one would hope that the judiciary and the lawyers involved are not going to be perpetuating rape myths.
Well, that's right. And it's a bit tricky here, really, too, because the Crown as well rely on them, right? So that if you have a complainant who has immediately told someone or immediately gone to the police, there's no question that the Crown will really emphasise that, because that fits with that general idea of what a real victim would do. So it's not just the defence who are saying, look, you need to look for, you know, kind of the tick box exercise. Have they told someone straight away? Did they resist? Did they call out? Did they cease contact? So all of those things are happening. So this idea of, you know, look for the things where you would expect, even though we know that that's not how all victims behave. And there is good psychological research to support the findings that sometimes people will be actually what they call tonic immobility. They actually can't physically resist. Or they may be really worried about resisting and escalating potential harm. All of those are possible reactions, and yet the ones that are really focused on are these ideas that, you know, if you were really raped, you would actually struggle, call out, resist, you know, run from the room as soon as you could. And what's not happening, particularly in the adult rape context, there is more what we call counterintuitive evidence being given to juries around children to explain delayed complaint, to explain ongoing contact with the alleged offender. But in the 40 cases that we had, there was none of that material given to the jury. So no expert evidence was offered, no material was given to them to say, well, actually, you know, there are misconceptions about what rape looks like, and you might want to think about those when coming to your decision.
Hmm. What are some of the changes you'd like to see in terms of the process?
Right. Well, some of them, I mean, there's a range of things. Obviously, things that we kind of noticed too was what kind of interaction the judges had with the complainants personally. Like, did they use their names? Did they explain the process to them? Did they thank them at their end of their evidence? So some of those kind of pastoral care matters, you know, responding when the complainant was obviously distressed during the giving of evidence. There's some really good practices around that emerging from the sexual violence court pilot. So a number of our recommendations are, let's see more of this, but also let's see less of that. And so some of it is supporting what the government is already looking at, and as in the sexual violence legislation bill currently in select committee stage. So this idea of developing counterintuitive directions to be used in sexual cases, that is part of the bill. And also, obviously, they're quite supportive of the pilot and of education and training programs for counsel and judges who are involved in these kind of trials. So very much support that. And we say in the book some of the kinds of things we'd like to see form part of that training. Because you still see, I mean, people, it's quite hard, I think, when you're out of your comfort zone. Most complainants only go into court once to give evidence in their whole lives, let's hope. And it's quite a foreign, unfamiliar environment. And the language that gets used is also unfamiliar. And I think that people working in the system all the time forget that. So you also see complainants going, look, I'm sorry, I don't understand. And that must be quite a hard thing to do when you're under quite a lot of stress anyway, to say, actually, I don't know what that word means. So I think some more emphasis on clear communication, language that is not full of legal jargon, is important as well. And then there's some things around the evidence and procedure, the more lawyery stuff, I guess. I support what the government has proposed, picking up on the Law Commission's work, which is extending the scope of the sexual history evidence rule to include previous sexual history with the particular defendant. I think that is important, and also the scope of that rule. And in terms of judicial intervention in the questioning process, there is a provision, and the Act is intending to make some changes to that. But what we noticed is, although judges are using that provision, and certainly more common and more often in the pilot cases, they're using it really when the questions are confusing or repetitive, and not really when the questions are belittling or mocking or reinforcing mythology. So that's one of the things we talk about in the book that needs some attention.
Yeah, because I had a quick scan of the sexual violence legislation bill just before. Yep. And am I correct in saying that they're wanting to extend it so that it would be inappropriate to question someone on their reputation or their previous sexual history?
Well, it already does exist.
Right, okay,
There is already a bar on reputation. What there isn't at the moment is that the rule around the admissibility rule does not currently apply to sexual experience with the particular defendant. It's only sexual experience with a third person.
Right.
And we're kind of out on the limb a bit in terms of other jurisdictions that we look to in terms of that distinction. So that's one of the things that is proposed to extend. And also to extend generally this idea that only sexual experience when you've actually done something. So what about an absence of sexual experience that's nevertheless being offered to say something about the actions on the day? So just clarifying some of those matters is what I think the bill is trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a bit of a big question that doesn't have one single answer, but if we were to actively try and break down rape myths that are being perpetuated, what would you like to see in terms of changes in the court process?
Well, I think it's going to be hard to resist them getting used at all, because I think it is part of how defence counsel challenge a complainant's evidence. But I think what is really significant and important if we're sticking to an adversarial trial process is that we embolden and enable judges to actually respond to those and in a way resist reliance on them by giving juries information to say, look, actually not, and we've got one provision in the Act at the moment about delay, where the judge can say there could be good reasons for someone to delay complaining, because we have a lot of evidence that suggests that, right? Well, we have a lot of other psychological, social science research now on a whole lot of things around how memory works, the impact of trauma, you know, this idea of tonic immobility. So those are the kinds of things that jurors may not know about, and what I'd like to see is them getting that information, and ideally from the judge.
Yeah. This is a really important, interesting topic. I wish I could chat with you longer for it today. I definitely might contact you later if I had more questions. But
no problem.
Yeah, was there anything else you wanted to add for today before I wrapped up?
No, I guess I would just say that this is, I think that this is a really good time for having information that actually shows what happens in the courtroom. And if nothing else, I hope that this work does that and informs the public, creates a space for some debate about what could happen in the criminal justice system in order to ensure, justice for all, not just talking about increasing conviction rates. I'm talking about people being able to come to court and feel like they were not re-traumatised by the process.
That was Law Professor Elizabeth McDonald speaking on her research regarding rape myths and the court process. And Safe to Talk is a helpline for anyone who's experienced sexual assault or wants to talk to someone about something at 0800 044 334. And also you can contact the Auckland Women's Centre as well, who have a great bunch of people there with resources and support at 09379 3227.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.